From WAMU 88.5 at American University in Washington, welcome to the Kojo Nandi Show, connecting your neighborhood with the world. Later in the broadcast, the Federal Diary column has been appearing in the Washington Post for the past 80 years. We'll talk with the current author of the column, Joe Davidson, about how it has changed over time. But first, in 2007, just before the global recession shook the world's economies, Nassim Nicholas Taleb warned against systems that cling to artificial stability, noting that not all events fall into neat categories where rules and axioms will prevail. Instead, in many instances, randomness is the prevailing principle, thus introducing the concept of black swans, events we never see coming that alter the course of history, and providing the framework for understanding the coming financial crash. Today, he returns with a new book titled Anti-Fragile, an expansion of his black swan theory and a how-to guide for moving forward in the face of disorder, advising us today on what to do in a world that we don't necessarily understand. Nassim Nicholas Taleb is Distinguished Professor of Risk Engineering at New York University and the author of several books, including the aforementioned Black Swan and his latest work, Anti-Fragile, Things That Gain From Disorder. Nassim joins us in studio. Good to see you again.
Thank you for inviting me again.
It has been a while.
A decade. I'd like to come back a little more frequently. Every 5 years.
I would hope so in the future. Oh, by the way, if you'd like to join the conversation, if you have questions or comments, just call us at 800-433-8850. When we think about something fragile, we might picture anything, be it a crystal vase or a complex, quirky computer program that could fall apart easily under stress. In a world ruled by the unexpected, you say we must strive for anti-fragility, a concept that is not the resilience or robustness we might expect. Why don't those terms capture the full meaning of anti-fragile?
Well, before that, let me tell you that the ancient Hebrews did not have a word for blue. The word for blue, kahol in Hebrew, came late, and the Greeks and Homer didn't have the word blue, the wine dark sea, right? So there are a lot of things we don't have a name for, and here, in fact, the anti-fragility is about half of life, and we don't have a name for it. Let me explain. When I ask someone, what's the opposite of fragile? The answer is usually solid, robust, resilient, adaptable, adaptive, all these things. But that's not the opposite of fragile. These solid and robust, they don't benefit from disorder. Okay, they're not improved by disorder. There has to be a category of things that benefit from disorder. They like volatility and chaos and variability and things like that. There's an entire class of things. And we don't have in common vocabulary a designation for them. I was an option trader for a long time. Mm-hmm. And option traders have a name for it. It's as inelegant a name as anti-fragile, maybe even more inelegant. So I couldn't pick it. It's called long vega or long gamma, all right? Mm-hmm. It means that you have a structure that benefits if there's turmoil. But there's no word. The problem is, and not having a word for these things prevents adequate policy making, adequate strategy in a firm, adequate implementation of, for example, health care approaches. So there's something that benefits from disorder, and we didn't have a name for it.
Well, we do now. It's called anti-fragile. You introduced us to the idea of black swans, events whose extreme consequences are entirely unpredictable and can be as disparate as the rise of the internet on the one hand and 9/11 on the other. How does a system that's anti-fragile help absorb the shock?
Okay, now actually it's not absorb the shock, it needs disorder. The problem, yes. And that's the central problem of the anti-fragile, is that it's not just that it is robust. It needs disorder as fuel, you see. So it benefits from random events, uncertainty, errors. And I pretty much have mapped things, as the first tentative of this book, into three categories. A glass of water you have on a table doesn't want volatility. the Brooklyn Bridge doesn't care. Okay. And there's a category of things that love volatility. And when you are fragile, you need to be extremely careful about the future. You need to be very predictive. When you're robust, you can be sort of careless. When you're anti-fragile, you need the volatility in the future, and you need uncertainty. And the more uncertainty in the system, the more you're going to gain in the long run.
Let's try some examples.
We're going to start with your human body and then move all the way to economic system.
That's where I was going to start. Body,
you have bones, all right? Okay, everybody who has bones needs some kind of stressors on their bones, and otherwise they become brittle. Okay, so
unexpected as those stresses may be.
They shouldn't be steady. It should be variable. Okay, this is very important to have some degree of variability. And of course, if you spend 6 months in bed, you're going to be in trouble. And if you're not exposed to germs, your system will weaken overall. So this is about your human system. This is why people try to sell you health club memberships. Okay, but buying a health club membership will not benefit you from disorder. You have to actually go there. Okay.
Yeah.
All right. So let's move to economic systems or general systems. The restaurant business benefits from disorder. If you didn't have mistakes in the restaurant business, and you would not have any evolution and been eating Soviet-style cafeteria food all the time. All right. The errors, it's a system that benefits, use errors as fuel. Silicon Valley does the same. Let's talk about transportation, okay? Air transportation is massively safe. It's almost as safe as crossing, safer than crossing the street, definitely, but as safe as walking around your living room, all right? It's very safe. Why? Because every plane crash is exploited to the hilt. No error is there in vain. You see, so the probability of the next crash drops after a plane crashes. Now let's talk about bad systems. Mm-hmm. The banking system, it doesn't make a lot of mistakes, but mistakes are huge. Mm-hmm. It's the exact opposite of a benign system. And the problem is, of course, that if the bank, unlike a plane crash, the probability of, if a bank crashes, the probability of the next crash is higher.
Mm-hmm.
So these systems are not built the proper way, the natural way. And let's also remember that evolution likes some degree of randomness to have mutations. Randomness, you need error, you need randomness, and random DNA changes. That's why we have genetic drift. And also, if you have 10 offspring and there's absolutely zero variability in the environment, the 10 will procreate, where evolution is about some kind of selective pressure. And these need randomness.
We're talking with Nassim Nicholas Taleb. He is Distinguished Professor of Risk Engineering at New York University, and his latest book is called Anti-Fragile, Things That Gain from Disorder. You seem to be suggesting that, before I get back to banking in particular, a philosophy that essentially says we're talking about survival of the most anti-fragile.
Exactly, and we have to realize that it's not so much at the level of the individual, but at the level of the collective. And let me explain. I mean, the restaurant, that fails is improving the system, but the poor restaurateur is being harmed, and we definitely have to do something about it. Entrepreneurs, we need entrepreneurs very badly.
Mm-hmm.
Now, entrepreneurs tend to be blinded by the odds. You see, and they get the short shrift in modern society because, in fact, the ones who really make the money are those who exploit them and the bonus earners who take over the companies later, but not entrepreneurs who actually have a lot of upside and a lot of downside.
Mm-hmm.
Now, most entrepreneurs fail, but we need them to fail for the system to operate. They're like fallen soldiers, mm-hmm. you see, but we don't give them the respect they deserve like fallen soldiers. So in a book, I have this romantic idea of the risk taker who needs to be protected by society because he is, in fact, sacrificing himself for the overall health of the system. And so at the level of collective, like people think it's what doesn't kill me makes me stronger. In fact, it doesn't work that way. It's what kills me makes others stronger. So people have, so we have to realize that we have to encourage some classes of risk taking and protect the failures. this system, America, is built on the exploitation of failures, or used to be.
Well, you think policymakers have been looking at the financial system as a machine, but that it's really more akin to an organic system. How did this apparently mistaken mindset contribute to the financial crisis in 2008?
Exactly. Since the Enlightenment, we started, we over-intellectualizing things, and given that we didn't have a concept of anti-fragility or any idea about the nature of complex systems, we made the classical mistake that I call mistaking your cat for a washing machine. And it's as follows. Anything engineered like a machine, like a watch, like a clock, the economy is not like a clock, all right? A clock needs constant maintenance. And you're not going to harm it by over-maintaining it. Whereas a human body or something organic, if you, you know, smooth, if you prevent the human body from experiencing any variability, you weaken it. So one, for one is use it and lose it. For the second one is use it or lose it. Okay, but the difference is very big because we became interventionist, thinking the economy needs an Alan Greenspan to smooth it out and eliminate variability. In fact, the economy needs variability. And he made the mistake, the classical mistake people make with by preventing every single forest fire. It lets the flammable material accumulate, you know, silently, and then the big one becomes worse. What Alan Greenspan did is by smoothing out the economic cycle, micromanaging this pseudo-stability, is move the risks into under the rug so you don't see the risks. Pretty much like in Saudi Arabia, we manufacture stability there with our foreign policy, and the risks are not visible. The system is very fragile, and don't see the risks. And of course, we blew the whole system, so we had a lot of hidden risk-taking in the system. So that came from someone who, if had you given Alan Greenspan nature, he would have eliminated the seasons. So we'd have 68.7 degrees year-round. You get the idea, every day, every minute, you see the idea. So this is a big mistake. Of not understanding that complex systems communicate with their environments for variability, volatility, stressors, and some kind of the need for variability is much greater than you think.
You've warned that high debt only makes an economy more fragile, and because of the debt carried by the United States, Congress now faces, and the president, of course, the prospect of falling off a fiscal cliff.
Yeah, the problem, we have a severe problem at all levels. Number one, a huge accumulation of debt that fragilizes the system. Again, I have three categories, fragile, robust, anti-fragile. Mm-hmm. And debt puts you squarely in a fragile camp. You cannot make a mistake. You have to be very predictive of the future if you have a lot of debt. If you don't have debt, you're a lot more robust and you can adapt. So you're in at least a robust category. The problem that we have had, recently, increasingly over the past 20 years, is a class of people who are themselves anti-fragile. They have upside, but no downside. That's anti-fragile, all right. And transferring their fragility to the system, namely bankers. Bankers have the upside and no downside as a class of people. You see, like a banker I mentioned in the book, I won't mention his name here. I got tired of mentioning his name. I got angry. Got $120 million of compensation from Citibank. And you and I, April 15, pay for it, you see, because Citibank was nearly in receivership and the taxpayer bailed him out. And he didn't come with a checkbook, we paid for the losses. So people who have the upside, no downside, there's an asymmetry there. And that asymmetry has never been greater in history. People who don't have downside risk, they're not harmed by their mistakes. People managing companies, people in government, not harmed by their mistake. What is the solution? Well, visibly decentralization is one solution because people locally are more harmed by their mistake because the reputation, because you can identify the source of the error, unlike someone working with a spreadsheet in Washington. So decentralization has to take place in order to, toughen up the system. And there are other considerations, but we have this asymmetry. Someone has the upside, other people have the downside. At no time in history have we had that.
Several questions come to mind. Is it your notion that fragility is what led to the idea that some institutions, banks, were too big to fail?
What I mean, what happened is that the larger the entity, the more fragile it's going to be. And the problem is when banks become big, we can't let them fail. So we start propping them up at the expense of the taxpayer. You know, in nature, very large animals tend to be threatened by the environment. You know, an elephant breaks a leg very easily, whereas a mouse, you can toss them out the window. I promise I won't do it here.
But, there are no mice here. Come on.
Okay. So you have small has a lot of advantages, much more manageable, but also more robust. I don't believe in economies of scale. But what we have had is companies becoming large, and then suddenly an increased moral hazard with the managers of these companies sort of exploiting the system. They're too big, they're going to be rescued by the government, and we taxpayers bail them out. And they don't have to return the bonuses of all these years when they were doing well. So this is a problem of size.
So do you think the centralized socioeconomic systems advocated and practiced by those countries that were communist or wanted to be communist, was that the essence of fragility?
Exactly. And let me explain where errors become large. As I spoke about the elephant makes, you know, is much more harmed by errors than a mouse. If I take a project of £100 million project in the United Kingdom, where we have data, £100 million project will have 30% more cost overruns than a £5 million project. Mm-hmm. So you realize that small is not just beautiful in the romantic sense; it's also beautiful in the it's economic sense. It makes a lot of sense economically to have something small, and things that are top down make fewer mistakes, but mistakes are terminal and irreversible. Things that are bottom up, like Switzerland, you know, municipal system. Any time you distribute the error, the possible error, that small decision with a lot of small errors, then you get closer to an anti-fragile system. Errors are confined and small, and it doesn't blow up the overall system. So decentralization has that effect. An economy where you don't prop up gigantic firms has that effect, because firms are forced, if not propped up by the government, they naturally break and become small. And then, of course, you have much better, you know, people are much more moral when they manage a municipality than when they manage numbers in a centralized headquarter.
Well, can major events of disorder help to promote anti-fragility, the stock market crash of 1929, or more recently, talking about the sequestration that could happen here if Congress and President, could that strengthen the economy in the long run?
I think putting volatility in a system, after the crisis, we tried to tame volatility a second time. Putting volatility in a system is very important, because volatility is information. And this is what people fail to understand. A system that is volatile, where you have panics, where you have markets, has information. So you get, and taming things doesn't give us information, so it may be too late. You want to make, as they say in California, which is a perfect place to understand these ideas, in California they say you need to fail early. So I'd rather, in this fiscal problem, fail early than fail late, when we can do something about it and get our house in order.
800-433-8850. Please don your headphones. We're about to go to the phone and take questions from callers. 800-433-8850 is our number. Did the Black Swan and Taleb's theory of randomness influence or change how you view the world? 800-433-8850. We go to James in Annapolis, Maryland. James, you're on the air. Go ahead, please.
I called a little too early, I think. My basic comment was just that I don't think there are very many actual Black Swans. I don't think very much is actually unpredictable or unpredicted.
The black swan. Let me explain the problem with black swan. A black swan for a butcher is not the same as black swan for the turkey. It depends on your perspective. Someone who knows, for the turkey, 2 days before Thanksgiving, it's a black swan event, but not for the butcher. And September 11, it was not a black swan for the people in. On a plane, but it was for people in a tower. So I've had a lot of arguments, people sending me thinking there's a black swan has a universal definition, not understanding that it's epistemic. It depends on the observer.
Thank you very much for your call, James. Does that indeed address your question?
Yes.
Thank you very much for your call. You too can call us at 800-433-8850. Do you agree that all organic things benefit from some level of disorder? 800-433-8850. You, I have observed, seem to have a special disdain for the news media, even saying your personal health has improved since you cut the daily newspaper out of your life. What, in your opinion, is wrong with journalism and the media today?
And this fell.
The headphones fell.
This is, but it's okay. A little bit of volatility is good. No, a little bit of volatility is good for you in the long run. There are several problems. The first one is we're not made to receive information at a high frequency. We should receive information. If you live in a natural environment, you should receive information at a much lower frequency. In other words, but then take it much more seriously. So we become dull to that information all the time. That's the first problem. The second one is the press. I mean, you're not commercial, but the press is commercial. Okay, and you're talking about my idea. The press is going to be interested in talking to you about something lurid. The press is much more likely to talk about shark in San Diego than about the risks of diabetes. Okay, the map people have of the representation of the risks they have of the world is completely distorted from reading the daily paper. The events are magnified. To figure out, you know, how bad it is, just read last year's newspapers of the same day, and then you realize that things you got excited about were in fact not significant. But it becomes harmful because, as I said, in The Black Swan, the previous book, the death of a child is a tragedy. The death of a million is a statistic, and nobody's going to talk about a statistic. And every day we have 7,000 people dying in the United States. A lot of them are preventable causes. But you're not going to read the newspaper about anything except a lurid death or something that can sell the daily newspaper. That's bad because we live in a global village, but we're getting the wrong side of the information of the global village.
Here is John in Alexandria, Virginia. John, you're on the air. Go ahead, please.
Yes, sir. So I wonder, like, if we're trying to look at things, can there be, is there an index we can look at to tell the antifragility of different systems?
Excellent. I there's a measure, the sensitivity of something to volatility. But they're very technical papers. I mean, in my chapter 18, I explain why you can say that why, for example, the coffee cup is more fragile than another one made in a paper. You get the idea. So there's a way to measure it and by via acceleration of harm. It's a little technical, but we can measure fragility of firms. We can measure fragility of a lot of things using a very simple concept of how sensitive locally that object is to volatility. And in fact, it's very easy to measure the fragility, much harder to predict events.
Yes, but if we can measure the fragility, even though we cannot predict the event, can our measurement of the fragility cause us to help that system to become anti-fragile?
Yeah, definitely. Once you measure fragility, you know what to do to reduce that number and the measurement number. I don't mind if my coffee cup is fragile, but I mind if my local bank is fragile. And the techniques now are all predictive, you know, but they're not they're like ones I'm suggesting to assess the fragility of systems. Someone with debt is a lot more fragile than someone without debt. You can do these comparative ranking as well.
Here is Benedict in Woodbridge, Virginia. Benedict, you're on the air. Go ahead, please.
Good afternoon, Kojo. Good afternoon, Professor.
Hi.
You are correct when you said that the organic will benefit from it. The principle that you speak of sounds like a Taoist principle, as stated as the Great Tao, that you will benefit from it. So you are correct.
Thank you.
I think he felt he was before you called.
No, but I feel now even more correct.
You feel validated now?
Even more, you know. I'm Bayesian, so I get more confidence as I'm getting more information.
Thank you for your call.
Thank you.
Benedict.
Thanks a lot.
You've been critical of a lot of academia's theorists. How do you distinguish your own work from the rest of the academic
body? Well, I mean, I started as a trader, and that's number one. And two, I've lived, I have skin in the game, and I have this concept of skin in the game, and let me explain it. Going back again to the banker. The banker doesn't have skin in the game. Anyone who's not harmed by a decision he's making, or she's making, will be negative for the system. Predictors are not harmed by the errors, but they cause people to have errors. And in fact, academia, particularly in economics, has survived selling bogus models and non-predictive things, as well as wonks here in Washington. Why? Because they're not harmed by their mistakes. Someone else is harmed. So it can continue. This is the problem. And same with after the entrepreneur sells the company, those managing the company, typically they're not harmed by their mistakes. It's either a shareholder or the taxpayer. So I want to change the perception. And in the book, I have a lot of studies of the contribution of academia, and not very impressive, because it looks like, I call it lecturing birds how to fly. It looks like a lot of things we attribute to academic, science, in fact, came from technology, and the technology from tinkerers and people who were, doing trial and error. And trial and error has error in it, small errors, okay? And they were exploiting uncertainty through that mechanism of bricolage or tinkering. And later on, someone put an academic stamp on it and explained in hindsight, what it was about and why they were looking for it. And it's a minority of things that were discovered by academia. Typically, it's a hobbyist. And these people, again, didn't get the good press in history because they don't write books.
Well, speaking of writing books, how do you explain the widely accepted conclusion in policy and research that a more formally educated citizenry brings more economic growth?
Well, we now have evidence that countries don't get rich when you increase education, but the reverse. Education increases when a country becomes wealthy. There's something I call epiphenomena, because we think that every country that's wealthy has a high degree of education, that wealth comes from education. In fact, wealth comes from risk-taking, again. At the family level, however, at your local level, okay, you need to educate your children simply because you stabilize their income, you see. But that washes out at the general country level. But you take countries like Korea, they had they got rich, then education went up, and now they have a high degree of education. So you think that was causal.
Oh, you're done.
Done.
I mean, in more ways than one. Your time is up.
Ah, okay.
Nassim Nicholas Talib is Distinguished Professor of Risk Engineering at New York University. He's the author of several books, including The Black Swan. His latest work is called Anti-Fragile, Things That Gain from Disorder. So good to see you again.
Great. Thank you very much. Thanks.